still as the soldier climbs in the saddle for one last ride. As the rain pours off his hat, you can see the shadows of the past written in his eyes. Now the cannons are silent, the sprints are all gone. Gotta put it all behind him if he ever wants to find his way home. He's the last rebel on.
Oh, the last rebel. Welcome, everyone, to Republic Broadcasting Network and the Rebel Madman radio program. Here we are on the 15th day of July in the year of 2023. And before we jump in today's program, I would like to ask you very earnestly to protect free speech in any way or manner that you can, by contributing to Republic Broadcasting. Go to republicbroadcasting.org, network.org, and let's do what we can to keep free speech, because it is rapidly disseminating in this country. Well, with that being said, my subject for today is about what separation of powers that we claim, or so many people claim, was written into the Constitution. And that is a fantastic fallacy. But I also am perplexed when I look at this. And I think about most Americans, if we went out and bought something and we put good hard-earned money into it and it didn't work, we would be perplexed. On the short side, we would be perplexed. But in most instances, we would be very upset. And this is one of the things that has been so hard for me once I began to see and do the research and to find out the actual true facts of the founding of this country. And that is, very simply said, that the creation of the Constitution of 1787 was done by a criminal cabal. And they wrote a constitution that would allow themselves, crooked politicians, to absolve themselves of the debts that they owed to the United States government. And not only that, but to lay a framework for future corrupt politicians to be able, as Alexander Hamilton referred to them, as the wealthy and the well-born, to always control the government. That was his wish, and it has happened. But we look at this Constitution, and we're told over and over, and there are plenty of people out there telling us over and over that it limits government, that it protects our rights, and none of that's true. But we keep repeating it over and over, like a hypnotized group of people believing a colossal lie. And the thing I would ask so many times is, if the Constitution limits government, if the Constitution protects our rights, when's it going to start? Because it doesn't. Number one, the Constitution right out of the box could not stop the adoption of an illegal law called the Judicial Act of 1789. It was not constitutional because it didn't meet the parameters of Article 5, but it was still signed into law by George Washington. And so the Constitution was amended illegally right out of the box. And then, of course, it did nothing to stop Alexander Hamilton in his pursuit of the U.S. Bank, which is we now call the Federal Reserve, same thing, just different name. And then, of course, it didn't stop the military invasion of Pennsylvania to collect a tax. The Whiskey Rebellion didn't stop that either, even though Article 4, Section 4 prohibited such an act, because neither the governor nor the legislature of Pennsylvania asked Washington and Hamilton to bring an army into their state to collect a tax and to put down a rebellion against that tax. Didn't work. And there, the one colossal thing we know, and it was predicted by two of the people we call founders, and one of them, of course, was Patrick Henry, and Patrick Henry predicted a civil war, and he said it would occur. He said it would occur within 100 years, and he, you know, it happened in 87 years, so he was 13 years off. But it still happened. And then an anti-federalist, you know, I hope I pronounced the name correctly, that he wrote under, but it was Philanthropos. And you have to be really careful when you look at some of these names like Philanthropos, who predicted the Civil War and said that it would occur if this Constitution was adopted. And he was spot on. So was Patrick Henry. But when you look at Philanthropos, one of the techniques that the Federalists used was they would seize the name of an anti-Federalist who was writing under a pseudonym, and they would seize their name and then do a publication supporting the Constitution in their name. And that happened with Philanthropos. Now, they couldn't do it with Patrick Henry, but they did put out fake news articles that Patrick Henry now supported the Constitution, when in fact he never did. That was your mainstream media of 1788, 1789. But folks, if the Constitution actually works, why did it not prevent the Civil War? Why did it not prevent several other wars? Why has it not prevented any of the wars this country has experienced in the past 22 years? None of these wars have been constitutionally declared, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. It hadn't happened. And especially, you know, what I really wanted to deal with today was the crimes of Reconstruction. And the Constitution not only did not stop those crimes of Reconstruction, the Constitution has never actually reestablished or punished anyone for those criminal acts that was done by the government. And we're going to show you in today's broadcast that in no way, in absolutely no way, was what was done constitutional, but also in no way did the Constitution prevent it from happening. So if you have something that limits government and you have something that protects the people's rights and it doesn't work, why do you still have it? Why do you still embrace it as this wonderful document? You know, and the one I point to so many times, oh, we have a Bill of Rights. Yeah, you've got one that says shall not be infringed, but it's been infringed over 2,000 times by the federal government. And how did the Constitution prevent that from happening? It hasn't. Hasn't in any way. Well, at the end of the so-called misnamed Civil War, the Republicans in charge, and that was the party of Lincoln, the Republicans were faced with a huge dilemma. And that dilemma was, during the war, we have been as nasty to the North, the people of the North, as we have almost as nasty as we have the people in the South. We have put at least 300 newspapers out of business. We have put thousands of people in prison without due process. And therefore, now that the war is over, if the South comes back in, if we bring the southern states back in and they elect representatives, they are certainly not going to vote for the Republican Party. So how do we handle that? And how do we, because we also have lost our foothold in the North even. with our unconstitutional criminal acts against the people of the North. So the Republican Party was in a absolute jam. So what could they do? Well, they had to come up with something that was going to continue their party into the future. They had two leaders, Charles Sumner in the Senate and Thaddeus Stevens in the House of Representatives. And they were staunch Republicans, and they had to come up with some kind of duty. And number one, and I believe this, and I think at some point in time I'll go into this on detail. I've done podcasts on this. But Abraham Lincoln was killed by the members of his own cabinet, executed by the members of his own cabinet, because there was a distinct possibility he had, well, he had not just a possibility, but he had contacted Judge Campbell, who had been a Supreme Court justice from the state of Virginia, but had resigned when Virginia seceded. And Lincoln was carrying on correspondence with Judge Campbell, and he had said to Judge Campbell, "Let's bring the southern states back in as if they had never left." And he had asked for Judge Campbell's assistance in this. Well, the people found it out. They found out about this. And so, they wanted, to make sure that, pardon me one second. And they wanted to make sure that these things were taken care of. And the message comes in from Judge Campbell and Lafayette Baker, who is in charge of the National Defense Police, which later became the Secret Service. He is manning the telegraph stations at that time. And Secretary of War Edwin Stanton had put the telegraph offices completely out of the reach of Abraham Lincoln, the president. He had to ask to see the telegraph messages that came in. So Edwin Stanton is talking with Lafayette Baker, and it's in Lafayette Baker's memoirs, in his notes. That's what I'm quoting from. So Lafayette Baker says to Edwin Stanton, "Well, we've got this telegraph here from Judge Campbell about assisting the president and bringing the southern states back in as if they had never left." And Stanton says to Lafayette Baker, according to Lafayette Baker, "Well, do not give that message to the president." And then Lafayette Baker says, "Well, what if, well, who's going to tell the president if we don't?" And the wonderful comment from Edwin Stanton was very telling, and he said, "We'll let the devil tell him." This is the day before Lincoln was assassinated. "We'll let the devil tell him." Well, again, as I said, the evidence is overwhelming in many respects that Lincoln's own people killed him because they could not allow him to bring the South back in, because it would have been the death knell of the Republican Party. The Republican Party would have been convicted of all of its crimes during the Civil War. It would have been convicted of its Marxist beginnings and its Marxist heritage that we have now. But they could not allow this to happen. And, of course, Lincoln's gone. And so now it's time, and Andrew Johnson is now the president of the United States, and they think they can manipulate him. You know, he had been a Democrat, but he had been involved in Tennessee and had been the Lincoln's governor of Tennessee, and then had been his vice presidential candidate in 1864, trying to give a representation of North and South in anticipation of the war being over. And, of course, the first thing that Andrew Johnson does is he gets drunk on his butt at the inauguration and makes a complete fool of himself, which bothered Lincoln to no small extent, but then very shortly after that, Lincoln's gone anyway. Johnson is now president of the United States, and the Republicans feel like he will be easily handled. So what they need to do is they know they cannot bring the southern states back in, not as they were, but they want the southern states to be completely and totally dominated by the Republican Party. And so they come up with the Reconstruction Act of 1867. Well, Andrew Johnson vetoes the Reconstruction Act of 1867, and he calls it a fantastic crime against the people of the South, which it was. But the Republican-dominated Congress was able to override his veto. And so we have the Reconstruction Act of 1867, which divided up 10 southern states. They couldn't put Tennessee in there because Johnson was from Tennessee, and you couldn't have kick Tennessee out of the Union and have a Tennessee man as president of the United States. So they only took the other 10 southern states, and they put them in two state districts, and each two state district had a Union general, a former or current Union general, as the commander of those. And then one of the first things they told the people of the South, these people, is number one, is to get back into the Union and to have representation, you must have and create a new state constitution, which we shall approve. If we don't approve, it is not acceptable. Now, that in itself is totally unconstitutional. The federal government cannot dictate to a state under the Constitution what kind of constitution they can have themselves. But today we have 10 southern state constitutions which are completely and totally unconstitutional because they were brought about by force and coercion. But, oh goodness, let's not talk about that. You know, gosh. But, and then again, to get back to the point about the North being alienated, was the first three states that Lincoln's army invaded when the war started were all in the North, and none of them had seceded. They invaded Maryland, they invaded Kentucky, and they invaded Missouri because they had to take over those governments of those states, because if they didn't control those states and those states seceded, the North was done. It was toast. The North would have been surrounded. At least Washington would have been surrounded by Confederates. They couldn't allow that to happen. So the primary goal of the Republican machine delegates to the state constitutional conventions. Now, here's the thing we got to think about. If you're putting together a convention to draft a new constitution, well, we're going to concentrate today on the state of Mississippi. You can't, you know, you just can't let them be the people who will vote against you as a Republican. So they had to come up with voter restrictions. And as I said, the primary goal of to elect these delegates to the state conventions was to frame constitutions which would exclude from the voting populace as large a number as possible of white people of the southern states, so as to ensure the success of the Republican Party by means of strictly, almost completely and totally, black voters. One method of ensuring exclusion of large numbers of white voters was to exclude leading men who had supported the Confederacy. Another method they used was to demand that before his voting credentials could be examined, a former Confederate soldier had to stand before a hypocritical Republican machine politicians, including military, and recite a humiliating public oath, fully realizing that every effort was being made to deny him the very equality of which he was required to pledge his allegiance. The oath required of voters, let me read you the one from Alabama as an example. I blank do solemnly swear that I accept the civil and political equality of all men and agree not to attempt to deprive any person or persons on account of race, color, or previous condition of any political or civil right, privilege, or immunity enjoyed by any other class of man. Now, ironically, they were making this pledge when the government was doing exactly what the people had to pledge not to do. The government was excluding the Confederates, former Confederates, from voting, and excluding white people from voting. Now, what did the Constitution do to stop this? What did the Constitution do to correct it? Or did the Constitution just let it happen? Although that oath sounds agreeable to people maybe today, if we read it, it sounds, you know, pretty cultural Marxist there. But in 1868, it was a calculated insult to any defeated former Confederate of white ancestry. And both the hypocritical Republican machine personnel and the former Confederate man knew full well that the Republican-dominated machine held the power to strip the voter rolls of enough white voters to deliver the vote they were seeking from the start with. So many defeated former Confederates, knowing the futility of political assertiveness, simply refused to be mocked before a voter registration board. I can imagine that today. I don't know any people of integrity that I know who would have walked in knowing what they knew and taking such a pledge. But this effort was coordinated from the Republican seat of power in Congress. For example, the chairman of the Florida Republican machine wrote to Mr. Stevens to assure him that the black people here have been led to look upon you with the highest respect and the most unshaken confidence. And he went on to explain the machine was using black churches because the black preachers are the great power in controlling and uniting the black vote. The Federal Reconstruction Act required that a reconstructed state constitution had to be ratified by a majority of the registered voters and not a majority of the voters who showed up at the polls on election day. You had to be registered, but your registration depended upon the military authority okaying you as a voter. Well, these organized Republican machine workers and members of the military delivered majority votes, primarily black votes, in ratification voting in Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, Georgia, and Florida. So in those states, the goal of a majority of registered voters was easily achieved. However, in Alabama, the machine turned out too few voters to gain a majority of those registered. Irregardless, the reconstructed Alabama state government submitted its reconstructed state constitution to the federal government for approval. Didn't even follow their own rules. What did the constitution do to stop that? Well, let's look at a comment from none other than Mr. Thaddeus Stevens, one of the leaders, and what he said about his legislation that he proposed at the federal level. He says, "True, I deemed the hastening of voting by black men in the federal states, or the North, as very essential to the welfare of the nation, because without it, I believe the federal government will pass into the hands of the Democrat Party. But on reflection, he decided to reword the last part of his bill to state will pass into the hands of the former Confederates and their friends." During this time, Thaddeus Stevens took measures to muzzle the federal Supreme Court. Ah, the separation of powers. Because he and his fellow Republicans feared a majority of the Supreme Court justices might actually vote to declare the Reconstruction Act as unconstitutional, and the Reconstruction Act and the military rule over the conquered southern states as unconstitutional. Well, the Supreme Court would soon be hearing a case concerning a Mississippi newspaper man by the name of William McCardle, who had been arrested and charged with publishing incendiary articles and tried by the military organization. Now, you have to understand here, there were no civilian courts in the South. There were no juries. Everything was conducted by the military authority. And the administration in Mississippi happened to be Edward Ord, Andrew Johnson's appointed military leader over the District of Mississippi and Arkansas. Now, the McCardle case had been appealed directly from the United States District Court of Mississippi to the Federal Supreme Court in Washington, because there was no intermediate federal appeals court at that time. Now, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens' bosom buddy in the Republican Senate, and other Republicans were just absolutely petrified that the Supreme Court justices might vote to declare federal military rule over conquered Mississippi in violation of the Constitution, which it most certainly was. So we can't have the Supreme Court ruling constitutionally here. We've got to do something to stop that. Well, let's kind of take a look at the math. 8 Supreme Court justices at that time comprised the federal Supreme Court. Yes, 8, not 9 as now. And 5 were known to be looking for a test case by which they could revoke the military rule over the 10 conquered states. The Congress knew this. The Senate had made the first move to strangle the Supreme Court in early December, passing a law stipulating that, with all justices voting, a 2/3 Supreme Court vote would be, in the future, required to declare unconstitutional any law passed by Congress. So they wrote a law in contradiction to the Constitution, and they were not going to let the Supreme Court rule on it because they knew it was unconstitutional. But then they noticed they had a real problem here. 5 of the 8 justices that they knew were looking for this case only constituted 62%, but they needed a 2/3 vote of 67%. Well, it quickly became obvious to everyone that the Senate was attempting to strangle the Supreme Court by playing with numbers. Ah, here comes that last rebel. We'll be back with you on the flip side, folks. Thanks for coming to Republic Broadcasting today.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Gilad Atzmon says the essence of Jewish power is the ability to prevent the discussion of Jewish power.
Jewish power requires anybody in politics to understand it and know about it, but never talk about it.
My Awakening really sums up with the very best evidence, the facts and the truth about race, and the fact that race drives history, and the truth about the Jewish question.
The younger you get, the greater the percentage of people who identify as alphabet soup, you know, LGBTQ, RS.
This woman, she's like, oh yeah, I identify as a koala 2 years ago. And I'm like, what?
A koala?
What? Maybe if it was Quickie Koala, that might be cool, but otherwise, you know. How about an N-word pass? Have you ever received an N-word pass from any of your black friends?
Biden invited a drag queen to come for the signing of the Respect for Marriage Act. It's a Respect for Anal Sex Act. So, yeah, I mean, let's just call it like it is.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EAZEOFF.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Your dad come government, you saw it so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, you dad come, dad come, dad come government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love him sometimes? Well, you dad come government, you better pay attention. You're sitting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get gum, get gum, get gum government?
Uh-huh. Yeah, thank you, Roger. Yeah, you nailed it there. A fool's convention. And, you know, I just wish that Roger was still alive and so he could do a song called that Dadgum Constitution, because it was the Constitution that created the government that we all hate. But we somehow think that the Constitution that created it is fine. Well, anyway, to get back to where we were going with this deal with choking the Supreme Court and not allowing them to rule on on the devastation of the South with Reconstruction. Well, as I said before, it was obvious to everyone that the Senate was attempting to strangle the Supreme Court by playing with numbers. The two-thirds hurdle would require a vote of 6 of the 8 justices, which in actuality would have been 75%. But in early January, the House debated intently the Senate's bill to strangle the Supreme Court. At one point, proposing to stop playing a numbers game, Thaddeus Stevens offered a substitute to the Senate bill, which would prohibit the Supreme Court from declaring unconstitutional any act of Congress pertaining to federal oversight of the conquered states. yeah, this is real. Of Stevens' amendment, a biographer of Stevens named Richard Current would write, and I quote, "Thaddeus Stevens would, by law, deprive the Supreme Court of any appellate jurisdiction over all cases arising from the federal administration over the conquered southern states." And for good measure, Thaddeus Stevens would forbid that these cases be reviewed in any other tribunal in any manner whatsoever. You get it now? Balance of powers? Yeah, okay. But Stevens' direct, in-your-face approach to strangling the Supreme Court was surpassed by a more clever proposal. And this was namely to prohibit the Supreme Court from hearing any appeal from a district court or a circuit court. Since the McArdle case could not be routed to the Supreme Court through an intermediate appeals court, the McArdle case would be excluded from being heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. Thus amended, this bill was passed by the House of Representatives and by the Senate. Now, as might be expected, Andrew Johnson vetoed that bill too. But both the House and the Senate voted to overrule his veto. The Supreme Court was thereby unable to render a decision in the McArdle case or even to look at any legislation involving federal military rule or making the state governments subservient to the Republican political machines. So, again, my question is, folks, where is the balance of powers? When did the Constitution stop these? When did it stop any of these usurpations? When did it stop the rape of the South? Has it changed? Has it corrected any of the things that we're allowed to do? You know, I know I've one of the things that just absolutely probably sets me off is reading people citing Supreme Court cases. Well, the Supreme Court said so-and-so, and that gives us our people. The Supreme Court has changed its decisions over 300 times. And I put up a little thing today on Facebook just to give people an idea of how to look at this. Let's say that 3 weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the sky is, in fact, pink. And that's an edict from the Supreme Court. You can't, there's no place to appeal it. But then, 2 weeks later, because of extreme pressure from the cultural Marxist, they decided that, okay, well, no, it's not that color after all. It's a different color. So the Supreme Court changed their ruling. Now, here's the point. Which one was constitutional? And if both of them are unconstitutional, what authority, where do you appeal their decisions? Well, as Brutus the Anti-Federalist wrote, the problem with this Constitution, there would be no appeal this side of heaven. So the Supreme Court is God, except when these Congress votes to shut them down. Now, where in the Constitution was the Congress provided with that kind of power? It's not. Just like these wars that have been fought since 1941 are all unconstitutional. Did the Constitution stop them? No. Did the Constitution prevent all of the deaths that have occurred because of these unconstitutional wars? No. Then why do we still look at the Constitution as this do-all to end-all? All we got to do is quote a Supreme Court decision and we're in. Well, the Supreme Court can change that tomorrow. And then where are you? Well, let's take a little closer look at that McArdle case. The McArdle case had been appealed directly from the United States District Court of Mississippi to the Federal Supreme Court in Washington. As I said before, because no intermediate federal appeals court existed. Now, as I previously stated, Charles Sumner in the Senate and Thad Stevens. Now, people, if you ever get a chance, these are two very interesting individuals. Thaddeus, let's go with Charles Sumner first. You know, he got caned really good by Preston Brooks I mean, he got the crap beat out of him. And that's one of my greatest memories of the U.S. Senate. But then, you know, he's kind of a weird dude. His wife left him because he was unable to perform his manly duties in the marriage. Okay, well, you know, that's none of my business, but that is official record. But then Thaddeus Stevens was kind of the opposite kind of guy. He was known as a huge womanizer. But both of these gentlemen they really feared the Supreme Court justices and that they might declare federal military rule over conquered Mississippi in violation of the federal Constitution, which it was. Absolutely. So, you know, we look at this and we look at it over and over and over. And here I'm going to give you a little bit of a description about the Mississippi deal. And listen carefully, because this is critical. The 61 counties in Mississippi, among them, the 32 with black majorities were given 70 delegates to the convention for a new state constitution, while the 29 districts with white majorities were only given 30 delegates. Of the delegates in attendance at the convention, 17 were black, 20 some were from the northern states, nearly all being former federal soldiers who had never lived in Mississippi prior to the war. 29 were native Mississippi whites who supported the Republican Party, and 19 were Mississippi whites holding what we would consider today a more conservative political philosophy. Now, there were some contested seats which held the body below the total of the convention, below the planned 100 delegates, 83 having answered the roll call on the opening day of the convention. Now, the first order of business in Jackson, Mississippi that day was fixing the daily pay and mileage allowances for all of the delegates and for hiring 30 convention employees and fixing their pay, which ranged from $15 a day for a reporter and a secretary to $10 per day for many of the others, all the way down to $5 a day for the lesser jobs, you know, the wood chopper or what have you. Every employee hired was either a black or a Yankee from a northern state. Delegates fixed their compensation at $10 per day and 40 cents per mile. Mileage payouts to delegates would average about $160 per individual and range up to $240. Mississippi taxpayers were to pay for the cost of this convention. A complete irony, considering that not one delegate nor one employee of that convention had ever paid taxes in the state of Mississippi. Now, at some point in time, I'm going to go into this in a broader detail, folks, and to point out in many of the states how Reconstruction was used to just absolutely siphon off all of the money possible. Many of these military leaders, Ord was one of them, several of the others were also part of this. They sent millions of dollars back home. And South Carolina is one especially. I hope to do that one, where the people of South Carolina were just, if you look at what these people actually owed at the beginning of Reconstruction in each state, and then their state debt at the end of Reconstruction, it's It's absolutely incredible. Well, the one thing, again, I think I touched on this. I'm really not sure. But talking about Stevens and Sumner and their address to the black delegates, they were told that the Senate and the House were, well, the Congress combined, was going to introduce a bill to give them a special and separate representation in Congress. The black men in each state to elect their own congressman at large. They were promised further that the federal confiscation of farmland would yet be enacted, asking them about the larger tracts of farmland and larger homes in each of their neighborhoods, and disposed of the opponents of any confiscation as tender-hearted fellows whose tenderness was really a softening of their brain. So in other words, the blacks were promised, if they would support the new constitutions, if they would support the new government, that they would be given the property that had been seized from these Confederates. Now, is anyone else here beginning to see the beginnings of an abject racial hatred that was promoted by the government? Is anyone else beginning to see that? Imagine you left your home, you left your family, you left your crops, you left everything of importance to go off to fight in a war because your country was being invaded by a foreign invader. And when I say foreign invader, I'm not stretching it, people. Many in Lincoln's army were not, in fact, actual citizens of the country. And the great majority of them, I mean, not a great majority, I'm sorry, but quite a few of them could not even speak English. So they were watching their home be invaded. And they went off to fight to prevent that, leaving everything behind. Over 80-some percent did not own slaves. They didn't have anybody to take care of their families. They didn't have anybody to harvest their crops. But defending their homeland was more important. So they left to go do it. The war is over. And for those who survived, now their property is being seized. Unless they take a stupid oath to the federal government, they will not be allowed to vote in their own states. And the candidates selected are never the ones that they would have selected to start with. Can you imagine the beginnings of a colossal hate for those people? Here was the original separation. Let's separate the races and get them to hate each other because it benefits the federal government. Folks, same thing's happening today. The exact same thing. Nothing has changed. Your Constitution hasn't fixed it. The Constitution has only made it worse. There is nothing whatsoever in the Constitution that limits the federal government. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 gives the government unlimited taxing powers. They can tax you for any amount they want, at any time they want, in any way that they want to, and there's not a darn thing you can do about it. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, the Necessary and Proper Clause. The government can do anything which it considers to be necessary and proper. You don't get to decide if it's necessary and proper. Only the government gets to decide. You know, just like in that Heller versus D.C. agreement, and Antonin Scalia, and everybody, you know, everybody got wet panties over that decision. Oh, the Second Amendment has been supported. they didn't read the majority opinion written by Scalia when he said all rights are subject to reasonable restrictions. Who gets to decide what's reasonable? You don't, and I don't. So what's it going to take for enough people to wake up and to realize that this Constitution was never what you thought it was? Never has been, never will be. The Constitution was written by a group of criminal politicians to cover the crimes they had committed during the Revolutionary War. Article 6, Clause 1, only the debts owed by the United States are valid. Not any debts owed to the United States. Not mentioned. Why? Because a great number of those men at the Constitutional Convention were the embezzlers who had embezzled the money from the federal government during the war. We had soldiers going without in the field, Valley Forge. We had revolts in the Revolutionary Army. Washington actually had men executed. Men who were deserting because they couldn't get food, they couldn't get supplies, they couldn't get anything. And yet these people like Robert Morris and others were pocketing millions of dollars. And so who got to write the Constitution? It wasn't the people who had been destroyed and had their property seized and those who had actually fought the wars. It was the wonderful government. Isn't that just absolutely a sweetheart deal, people? It's amazing. You know, and I'm going to quote to you from one of the Anti-Federalists. His name was Samuel Bryan, and he wrote as Sentinel. And I use this as verification, people. I resort to original source documents, not something written by the Heretic Foundation or Prager University or some other university that's on the government Marxist payroll to produce whatever the government tells them to. But here is the essay from Sentinel, number 17. To the people of Pennsylvania, fellow citizens, in my last number, I exposed the villainous intention of the framers of the new Constitution to defraud the public out of millions lying in the hands of individuals by the construction of this new system, which would, if established, cancel all debts now due to the United States, as I referenced before. I also show that thereby the delinquent states would be exonerated of all arrearages due by them on former requisitions of Congress. And to prove that the canceling of all public dues was premeditated in regard to individuals, I stated that the General Convention, the Constitutional Convention, contained a number of principal public defaulters, and that these were the most influential members of that group, and chiefly instrumental in framing a new constitution, in answer to which the conspirators have, by bold assertions, produced spurious vouchers and insufficient certificates, and they have endeavored to exculpate one member, Robert Morris, and to alleviate the weight of the charge of delinquency against another, Gouverneur Morris. In the face of a resolution of Congress of the 20th June, 1785, declaring their intention of appointing three commissioners to settle and adjust the receipts and expenditures of the late financier, who was Robert Morris, the conspirators have asserted that his accounts were settled in November 1784, for which they have no vouchers. And by a pompous display of certain resolutions of Congress respecting a particular charge of fraud against him, as a commercial agent to the United States, they vainly hope to divert the public attention from his great delinquency in never accounting for the millions of public money entrusted to him in that line. When we consider the immense sums of money taken up by Mr. Morris as the commercial agent to import military supplies and even to trade in behalf of the United States at a time when the risk was so great that individuals would not venture their property, that all these transactions were conducted under the private firm of Willing and Morris as commercial agents to import military supplies and even to trade in behalf of the United States, that all of these transactions, which afforded unrestrained scope to speculation and embezzlement of the public property by enabling Mr. Morris to throw the loss of all captures at the hands of the Redcoats at that hazardous period of time onto the public. In other words, if they were seized, the public had to pay for them under Robert Morris. Now, isn't that wonderful? And he converted the safe arrivals, which were consequently very valuable, into his own private property and then sold them to the U.S. government. And when we add to these considerations the principles of the man, his bankrupt situation at the commencement of this late war, and the immense wealth he has dazzled the world with since, can it be thought unreasonable to conclude that the principal source of his newfound affluence was the commercial agency of the United States during the war? Well, it goes into great detail, folks. They touch on the corruption, the absolute corruption of these men who sat in Philadelphia, those people today we call founders. And let's not forget that the General Assembly of the State of Pennsylvania published in October of 1787, published a document in which they stated, got the music coming, guys. We'll be back on the other side. Join us then. Phone calls, second hour, please.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
Truth. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.